she knows.
Blog Talk Radio.
She's here. Good morning, everyone. Oh, my God, this is going to be stupendous. Absolutely stupendous. This is Literary Viewpoints, MJ Network, in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, and we have a Lollapalooza today. This show is going to really rock. And if you're an educator or a student in the seventh grade, you need to read this and learn a whole bunch of lessons. But before I start, I would be remiss if I didn't, seriously, I don't know if I should laugh or cry, thank the people at Animal Control for last Tuesday for coming to see where the bat was that was hiding in my house that is no longer here and got buried somewhere, thank God. I want to thank Jerry personally and the police department for not laughing too hard, and the people at Dobbs Ferry Emergency Room for when I walked in and saying, the patient is here, we're ready with your six shots, don't worry, they're not going to hurt. They really didn't. So I want to thank Kathy and everybody at the staff of Dobbs Ferry Emergency Room, and they're still laughing. They'll probably laugh this morning when I come back there. Okay, so we have the author of Seventh Grade Revolution here, and I have to tell you, if you haven't read this, this is one of those books that Gabe Fran, I read it in one day. I just sat down and read it. I needed something that was fantastic. So we've got a group of seventh graders that are normal, that the teachers announced that they're going to take over a bloodless revolution. Now, I think that is absolutely the coolest thing, but the FBI is outside, and they're up to no good, too. I'm not sure that they would like that, but, oh, well, you never know what they're going to be up to. So we have Leanna Garner here. Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great this morning.
That is great. So tell us, how did you create this novel? And who is the teacher that, you know, that gave you all this information? That's fantastic to be able to get somebody. And Cheryl's on the line, and she says hi.
Hello, Cheryl. How are you doing? I was playing around on Twitter. I was probably supposed to be writing at the time and, you know, procrastinating as usual. And I happened to see an article going down my feed and clicked on the link because something about it intrigued me. And I went to this very short, probably about 3, maybe 4 paragraph article on a classroom experience that was happening in North Carolina about a situation where the teachers brought in the entire seventh grade and sat them down on a Monday morning and told them that there had been a bloodless revolution over the weekend because they were not happy. The kids were not happy with how the school was being run. The kids won, and now they had to form their government and create their policies. And my mind just exploded with possibilities based on that little scenario. I couldn't even get over how wonderful an experience I thought that would have been. I wanted to go sign up and be in that seventh grade class right then and there, you know, make room for me. I would have loved to have been in that particular situation. So, you know, I'm reading this article. I know there's a book there. And just even down to one of the kids, of course, being a smart aleck, as they are sometimes want to do, had put forth a suggestion that they work on the dress code and that girls would have to be, you know, that they had to wear spaghetti straps and in their attire. And just, you know, I can see, I had friends in my classes that would have suggested the same type of thing. So I just thought that was fantastic, and reached out to the teacher because they had mentioned Karen Rectanis and the school. And so I got on Google, and there was an email address, and I thought, well, I'm going to just take a chance and see whether she's open to helping me with providing a little bit more detail. And she was fantastic. I was able to tell her how to extract the entire Twitter stream because one of the things that they were doing, the teachers were there in the guise of the media. And so they were tweeting the experience. So, of course, I added them to my Twitter stream and was following along as well. But after it was over, she was able to give me all of the tweets, which I do include at the back of the book, and they're just hysterical to read through. And in addition to that, they had given the parents homework, and parents had to provide report on what the kids were talking about the experience at home. So what the, you know, kind of how they were talking about things, because what, how you portray something at school may be a little bit different than how you are talking about it at home. And so they got all that feedback. And so she also shared that with me. And I was just so thankful that she was open to some basically unknown writer coming to her and saying, hey, I think this is going to make a great book. Would you be willing to help me out?
That's fantastic. I know, I'm looking at the back of the book, and the tweets are there for anybody that wants to see it. But let me just interject and just tell everybody that because of one experience a couple of months ago, I take questions on my Facebook wall, because there are some people out there that don't appreciate good programming, and sometimes their comments are really have nothing to do with the book. They're just being nasty and rude, and I won't tolerate that. The program is being taped and recorded for Blog Talk Assurance, Blog Talk Radio. They just make sure that there's the quality assurance during the show. So when creating the rules for this revolution, which I thought was really cool, you sort of set guidelines on it. So the students were not allowed to change certain things, and certain things they were allowed to change, like chewing gum in class or, you know, stuff like that, fun stuff. So why the two-day time frame that they had to do this?
Well, I think for the teachers were trying to structure the module, which was basically American Revolution happened. What happens after a revolution? You know, you basically, you've created chaos. How do you then bring chaos back into control? So, which is a fantastic lesson. And it really, the thing that just blew my mind is how relevant this exercise makes history. And I applaud any educator who can teach, especially your like 7th, 8th grade level, that history is relevant. And they were able to tie it to things that were happening at that moment in the Middle East. So I thought that was an absolutely fabulous premise and ability to get kids to think outside of their normal method of thinking about history and how it applies. So at any rate, they're putting together these rules, and the structure of the module was that they would have 2 days to come up with their policies and create the schedule for the school, put the rules into place. They would have a day of discussion, and then they would run the school by what the kids had determined for those final 2 days of the week. So it's basically the structure, the constriction, I believe, was based on we have a week to do this. And so that's how they ended up putting the structure in place.
Well, there's Dennis Rhonda Spence. Yeah, I think that was brilliant. I mean, they were trying to actually be organized, but you know how kids are. Everybody wants to take the lead or not take the lead, and nobody wants to listen to anybody at first. So you have Dennis.
Right.
Rhonda, Spencer, Charlotte, Brooke, Selena, and Curtis. I think I have this memorized, let me tell you. So they start to create the rules. I mean, this is, you have to read it because it's so fantastic. I mean, I think actually schools should try this on a day or actually do a play based on this, because I really think you could learn so very much. So they created their rules and they have this chart. So why does Maddie, in her goodness and goodness of heart, try to take over and start? And what happens when she does that, which is also not unusual for kids? I think that was fantastic.
Right. Well, Maddie is used to taking charge. She's pretty much one of the kids that she's a leader, you know, and she also, she cares about her grades, and so she wants to get everybody started. And of course, at first, nobody else is doing it. So there's Maddie. She's going, you know, nobody else is going to take charge. I'm going to take charge. And, you know, she has a little conflict over with Selena over that, because, you know, as far as Selena's concerned, she doesn't really care who's taking charge. It's just she's annoyed that Maddie is once again trying to tell everybody what to do. So you've got a little bit of of bossiness maybe in Maddie, but it's more of, you know, I want to make sure that this is a success. I don't want to fail. And part of the motivation for it, too, is the fact that the teachers were live tweeting the experience, and they mm-hmm. didn't want to fail on a public basis, you know, because that if you're just in school and it's not going anywhere else, that's one thing. But when what you're saying is then showing up on, they had the Twitter stream up on a screen. And so when things would happen and, like, you know, chaos reigns is one of the tweets. And that goes up on the screen, and the kids are all seeing this, and that definitely puts a pressure on them, because this is no longer just them. It's no longer confined within the four walls of the room. It is beyond the school. It's the public. And they did get national attention from this particular exercise when it occurred. So that just is, and then Maddie is not an actual student in the school, but she's my creation of, and she exemplifies the kid who is going to take charge. And when she does, she gets the typical response of, you know, she's trying to take charge and nobody's listening, because that's exactly what happened. You've got some that will listen, and you've got others who are just going to be doing their own thing, which is what was expected, anticipated, and happened.
Well, adults are not that any different, unfortunately.
No.
I mean, if you see you see the protests on television, they're supposed to be organized, there's supposed to be somebody leading them, but there's not always somebody leading them, and people go off in their own direction, that's when people get hurt.
Right.
So one of my favorite characters is Dennis. And he does a complete 360 after a while. So when he realizes what's going to happen, he hears the radio outside, and he realizes what's happening, and he's talked to the other children, other students. But he and several others, you know, they have to play pranks on each other. I mean, if it wasn't fun to play juvenile pranks on your friends, what's the point? But when do they realize that something serious is happening outside?
Well, they were down in the basement to have a secret ballot vote, and the reason for the secret ballot vote was in two parts. One of the kids, Spencer, who is your class clown, he's the one who's always being disruptive. He loves playing the pranks, and he didn't want to spend all day long talking about boring things, so he proposed that they have a vote because they had a few things up on the board. Well, why don't we just vote on them? And if we have agreement, then we don't have to talk about it, and we can just move forward. So that was part of his motivation. And then the other part of the motivation is, if we make it a secret ballot vote, then the teachers can't come with us because they're the media and they have to be kept out because it's secret. So that's, you know, that's where they all end up down in the basement. They have an auditorium in the basement called the dungeon. And so the entire grade troops down to the dungeon. And once they get there, of course, it's supervised, an unsupervised group of kids in a room. The noise level would have had to have been fantastically loud. And so they don't hear the rest of the, plus the basement is rather insulated. So they don't hear the alarms going off and the rest of the school being evacuated. Because they're just down there, and, you know, some kids are fighting with swords and signs and all sorts of stuff. There's a group that's having conversations, and, you know, there's a small group trying to get things organized, but it's just incredibly loud, so the kids don't hear what happened. So when then they do finally settle down, have their vote, and are going back out, when they go to enter back into the school area from the basement, there's just a sense that there's something wrong, that something's different. Rhonda is the one who opens the door, and it's just too quiet. There's not, it feels empty. And that's when they discover that there are people hanging around outside the school. So they stay down in the basement where they can't be seen until they can figure out what's going on outside. And
that's
where Dennis and his little hacked app comes into play, because he can tap into their frequency.
I know. If you don't play practical jokes in your life, you're no fun. And
exactly.
You just have to, I know, but you got to be careful not to. But, I mean, everybody does. I mean, my sister and I used to do it all the time, but nothing crazy, like silly phone calls and stuff like that, and then hang up and say stupid stuff and never get caught. I mean, it was fun, but back then it was there were no caller IDs, or nobody knew you did it. So when they realize that the FBI has evacuated the school, and what do they think that they're looking for at first? What do they think the FBI is doing? So they have to, and they don't want the FBI to know that they're there.
Right. The way that it kind of crops up is that when they discover it's the FBI, they're first, of course, in total shock, because, first it's just these strangers, and, they don't know who they are, so they don't want to let those strangers know who they are, and it's just weird that everybody else seems to be gone. So they do learn that the school has been evacuated, and these guys are the FBI. And they learn at that same time that the FBI is searching for an artifact that has national importance to it. And they are willing to close down the school in order to find the artifact. And that becomes a kind of rallying point for the kids, because nobody's going to close their school. If they don't, this is their school. This is not the FBI school. And they then decide that they want to find what the FBI is looking for before the FBI can get in there.
I know that's scary, because they really went through a lot back and forth. And this is when they change their attitude towards each other. This is when they have to realize that there's only us, and we've got to do something about it. So Rhonda, who everybody thinks is a nerd and whatever, is great with survival skills and survival training, and she's smart. So how does she use her survival skills, and what supplies do they need? I mean, this was fantastic how they got water, they got this, they got that. How did they know where to find everything, and how did they know, what would happen if the lights and the water went out? How did they fortify themselves for the 2 days?
Well, Rhonda has been trained in survival skills by her father, because he really wants her to be able to care for herself. And so one of the things that he has taught her is that in a situation like this, one of the first things that, it's strategy. If you have an opponent that's outside and they want to weaken you, what they're going to do is they're going to cut off access to necessities. And if they can cut off the access to necessities, they weaken you without force. So if you take away power and light and you take away water, eventually someone's going to have to cave in that situation, because you can't live without water, and they're down in a basement without electricity. They would totally be in the dark. And let's face it, not an entire grade is going to stay down there in the dark. So Rhonda realizes this, and she knows that that's a standard tactic for weakening an opponent. And she then rallies everybody and says, okay, we need food. We need water. We need to make sure that if they cut off the power, that we have access to the generator so we can get the generator going, so that we at least have power and light down here. And she also, I just lost my train of thought. Sorry about that. She is recognizing what it is that they do need in order to withstand the FBI's involvement and trying to weaken them.
Well, when they finally get it all together and they search through the tunnels, they have to be really careful. And when they're searching through the tunnels and they're looking for blueprints and stuff, what do they think they're going to find?
They're really not sure what it is that they're going to find. They are just wanting to find whatever it is that the FBI is after. And what they have learned is that it is some sort of piece of, it's referred to as an artifact, and it's some sort of art. The FBI actually doesn't know exactly what they're looking for. They just know that something has been secreted in the school, and they have certain clues. The FBI has certain knowledge, so they actually have a better idea of what they're looking for than the kids do, but neither one of them knows exactly what it is that they are searching for. It's just something that has, from the Revolutionary War time, that has been hidden somewhere within the confines of the school by the owner of the house that the school is housed in, Silas Tucker, who was a complete and utter dyed-in-the-wool Revolutionary War buff. He was alive during Civil War, and he built his house after Civil War occurred. So he had this, I don't know exactly how he ran across this, but he had this artifact that he has hidden. And with this artifact is something that the FBI feels would be detrimental on a national level, and that is why they are there to find it and take it away before it becomes public knowledge.
I know, that was really, and they go through the tunnels in the basement. Let me get to my next page of questions. I've got tons more. When they finally get the blueprints and stuff, who was able to read them and figure out where to look? And then how do they remain silent and not allow the FBI to know that they know? This is clever. I mean, I don't know how many kids today could do this, but then again, they're all technology savvy, so you don't know. So they get the blueprints, and they're looking around, and they're reading them, and Rhonda's reading them, and the rest of them are reading them, and how do they know that, you know, how do they know when the FBI is going to strike? Do they hear them? They don't talk to them. They're not
aware.
They
don't talk to the FBI, but Dennis has a police scanner app on his phone. And he has a friend from a previous school. Dennis has kind of gone from school to school. He's been kicked out of a lot. He's not really good in a school environment. He's a good kid overall, but he doesn't take well to rules and authority, and has had some difficulty. So at any rate, he has a friend from a previous school that has modified his app so that it can pick up frequencies which he normally would not be able to. So he is able to tap into the frequency that the FBI is using to communicate their information back and forth. And that is where they're picking up the little bits and pieces of what the FBI is looking for and what their plans are. Now, the FBI made, when they evacuated the school, that brought attention to their being there. And so the powers that be in the FBI wanted to make sure that that didn't happen again. They didn't want any more attention drawn to the school because they didn't want the media coming in before they had recovered the artifact. So everything had to be kept quiet, which was actually one of the big key factors for the kids. That was the thing that they are able to leverage, is that the FBI needed to keep things quiet. So they have that bit of information that, you know, and they are able to use that as one of their strategies in dealing with the FBI. The reason they were able to keep quiet was the insulation in the basement, and the FBI apparently could not hear them in the basement. So anytime they had to go into the school, they made sure to keep low under the windows and keep very, very quiet. Other than that, if they're in the basement, then they were not able to be heard.
They were lucky that they were able to have connection down there, too. I mean, usually when you're in a basement, I know if I'm in a basement in somebody's house, a lot of times you can't get connection. So obviously whatever radio, whatever he had to have a powerful connection. That is great. So we've got Dennis and Rhonda. And what I love about Rhonda is that at first she didn't have very much self-esteem, and she didn't feel very great about herself, but that changes. Even Dennis's attitude towards Rhonda changes. So how does this whole event change Rhonda's feelings about herself to make her realize, I can do this, I can do anything, and no one's going to put me down? Because a lot of kids have low self-esteem, and that's the hardest thing for an educator to change, and I know that.
Yeah, I think part of it was that her peers started looking to her for the answer. So instead of being the nerd and the kind of freaky one that had all this knowledge about survival skills and that she got teased about before, and I put a little bit of that in there. She gets teased about the things that she knows and, her quirkiness. And all of a sudden, it's partly because their attitude changes, because all of a sudden, those things that she knows no longer are strange, quirky things, but things that they need. And she starts to come to the forefront of the class as the person who has the knowledge to get them through this in the best way. And it's not that anybody states that, but it's just all of a sudden they're looking to her, and she's like, me? Why would you want me to be leading? And Maddie, who is used to leading things within the structure, all of a sudden when that structure is removed, she doesn't know how to lead. She doesn't know what to do without the defined structure in place. So there's a subtle shift that happens where Maddie is no longer charging to the front and saying, this mm-hmm. is what we have to do, everybody get in line. And everyone doesn't know who to look to until they realize that Rhonda has the knowledge that they need. And that's a very powerful thing mm-hmm. as far as esteem is concerned for Rhonda, that, wow, wait a second. Now everybody else is seeing that I have value. Maybe I do.
When it comes from your peers, for some reason, it matters more than anybody else. And for some reason, unfortunately, kids go by what their friends think. Instead of thinking that, it doesn't matter, and I'm who I am, they fall prey to the nastiness of other kids. And I know that from teenage
right.
nieces, nephews, and whatever. And you try to teach them that you have your own personality, you're who you are, you don't follow the wrong direction. And you have to keep reminding them that. So they become a unit. Maddie and Selena become friends too. And what dawned on me was that parents and teachers, they must have been wondering, what happened to the seventh grade outside, but they couldn't exactly tell them. So there are many obstacles that overcome, but when Rhonda finds something in cigar cans, why does she not tell them?
Well, when she finds the things in the cigar cans, the reason that she doesn't mention it is that a secret is only a secret when one person knows it. So the more people who know, then the less secret it will be. And when it comes to, because what she finds is money, and greed would kick in, and she didn't want for everyone to get thrown off what their actual mission was. Because if everyone knew about what she had found, then the focus would become on that room, which is not the focus of what their mission was, which was to find the artifact. So she was more focused on that. And if people knew about what she had found, greed would have been a factor, and she didn't feel like she was ready to fight or battle against those who would have wanted to just take the money and run type of attitude. So it's something that it wasn't something she talked about, just very instinctual. Wow, this is a lot of stuff here. Also, there was ammunition in there, and it was very old. And there's questions as to whether, if you start playing around with that stuff, if it would start to go off, and really she didn't want anybody to get hurt. So there were a lot of reasons kind of built in into that, and it's just something she felt better to keep a secret versus telling the entire grade.
That's true, because when you tell one person, it becomes three people, becomes somebody else.
Yep.
So then they find the artifact, and we won't say what it is. And who is Patrice Wright, and how does this link to this person? That was really interesting.
It's actually, her name is Patience Wright. Patience Wright was America's first sculptor. She worked in wax, and she, and this is actually a true part from history.
Yeah.
She and her sister were wax workers, and she would fashion busts of the people, notable people of the time. She did a lot of Ben Franklin, who was a friend of hers. And she did some of George Washington. Well, at some point, she had traveled back to England, and her sister remained in Pennsylvania. And Patience was working in King George's court, and she was doing busts of the nobles. And the war broke out. And what she did was she would hear things while working in the court, and she would put notes in her bus and send them back to her sister about what the plans were by the British so that she could let the revolutionaries know what their plans were. So she was actually a spy in King George's court during the Revolutionary War, and I found that to be absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew immediately that I wanted her to take a part in this book. And so that's how she ended up in there.
Well, before I continue, let me just tell everybody. On December 4th, the author of Snifter and Death, Watch Out What You Drink, is going to be here. On December 6th, one of my favorite people in the whole universe is going to be here, John Land, Strong to the Bone. On December 11th, D.P. Lyle, who consults for CSI and Criminal Minds, will be here to talk about A-List. And on December 12th, because of what's going on in the news, in the schools, and bullying, and the attacks on teachers, FBI agent Michael Tabman and I are going to take a closer look at school safety, public safety, a hospital safety, and hotel safety, and what needs to be done in order to correct it, metal detectors in the school. And for those of you that don't know, the murder that was in the Bronx was in my school that I went to. So that sort of hit home. On the 14th, we have Bruce Coffin, Beneath the Depths. And on the 19th, we have Reese Hirsch, Surveillance. And that's just this year. Next year's January is filled. February is almost done with my show, and you never know what's going to happen next. So, who created the illustrations? The illustrations are fantastic. They tell their own story. And you can actually see the story. It's fantastic. So how did you create the illustrations, and how did you create each pictures of all the kids?
Well, when we were putting the book together, we talked about maybe having a few illustrations in there, and happened across artist by the name of Luke Spooner, who has his illustrations under Carrion House. And he had done illustrations for a couple of books that my agent's clients had participated in, some anthologies. And they were very interesting. They were different. And so we went to Luke and asked him whether he would be interested in illustrating Seventh Grade Revolution, and he was, and he came up with some really fantastic art with, you know, with regards to the storyline. And what Mm-hmm. What we did is I basically sent him, here are some ideas for the pictures, and I gave him a little bit snapshot of kind of what I wanted to portray, the moment from from that particular chapter. So that's pretty much what happened with that. And I think that they really portray the book well. In fact, I took the when we were all said and done, we ended up with 47 illustrations. And I thought, wait a second, that's close to 52. So I have made a deck of playing cards with the illustrations, and I have those for sale on my site, just because I thought it would be fun to have something that after you read the book, they mean so much more, and you can have a Seventh Grade Revolution thing playing cards.
Well, I thought it was great because I'm looking at Rhonda and what she finds, and I won't say what it is, and that picture is fantastic of her. And we have Lighting the Grotto, and we have poor Rhonda faces her worst fears. That's a scary one. And I think that the greatest one was Paul Revere's Ride, the picture of that. And then you have
yes.
the one at the end of the FBI outside looking out the building. And the building, the school, actually looks like a haunted house. It looks scary, wherever
mm-hmm.
they are. And as many people, and there are shadows, there's a whole bunch of people on top. So you actually think that you're being invaded by a SWAT team or something. And, of course,
yes.
Dennis, and then they have the news and stuff. This is like absolutely fantastic, and of course the picture of you, of the teacher that helped you, Miss Rictanis, returns to the school. That was fantastic too, and the ending of the book we won't give away as to what she does. So when deciding what happens at the end, it seems that there'll be more lessons for these kids. Are you going to bring them back as amateur detectives?
You know, that's something that we've talked about. I did leave a little bit, and not, again, going into detail, but I did leave some potential holes at the end where there are things that they could go and investigate. There are just a few things that when they were down in the tunnel and finding the artifact, there are some questions there. So it's not that I have anything specifically planned, but should we decide that we want to go with another book, absolutely there is enough there that as far as a starting point that I can continue on.
I definitely think that you have a series here, because seventh graders can do almost anything. And
yes.
I mean, just interviewing seventh graders, you can find out so much. I mean, I go into the bakery in the morning and I hear them talking, and you learn a lot from kids. And
mm-hmm.
They could tell you what's going on in school. They could tell you what they like. They could tell you what they know. We wonder what would happen if one of them took over for principal for the day. They've done that in my school a
mm-hmm.
long time ago, where they have a child walk around with the principal to see how it is to run the school and how you would feel if you ran, like I did, 500 children in the lunchroom. I was able to do it, but there are a lot of people that can't. So
right.
this the basement and the tunnels come into play in this mystery. How did you create that particular part? And did you actually see any basements and tunnels or take some pictures? Because the pictures in the book actually make you feel as if you're there.
No, I didn't take any pictures and have not been. It wasn't based on anything. In reality, it just is. As a kid, I loved a book that had a tunnel, you know, any secret sort of thing, secret staircase, secret tunnel. I love things like that. And I knew when I started that I wanted something. And of that nature within the book. And the owner of the house that built the house that the school was housed in would have definitely added those things because of his personality mm-hmm. and who he was. He absolutely would have put a secret room and a tunnel to escape through. And the reason he would do that is because he's building his house just after the Civil War. So he's been through a war. It was very contentious. Families fighting one another, even. And he wanted something to keep him safe should another war break out, and if necessary, something to help him get away. So that was, you know, the thinking behind that. But I knew from the very outset that I wanted to have a secret tunnel that was built into the structure.
I actually think, I'm just writing notes as I'm talking, as I'm listening, that each child in this series could be a character in the book, could be a lead character by themselves. There's enough there, especially Dennis and Rhonda. They could actually, you know, be the detectives to help the security guards at school solve the crimes. So what I thought was really cool. I mean, as the dean, I used to have all the tough kids walking with me. And they go, Miss Lewis, don't worry, we got your back. I go, you're lucky if I don't have your back. Don't worry about it. I'm not worried about it. And I think the greatest thing is to have the toughest kids know how it feels to deal with tougher kids. And these kids learn, you know, a lot of lessons about themselves. And I had one boy, I said to him, you're probably the most difficult child in this school. He said, well, why don't I write the rules on a chart for everybody to follow? I said, you got it. And he wrote them right. I said, so now you have to follow them or you get to write them more. It was hilarious. I mean, the way to teach them is to make them understand, yeah, this is what you can't do. So what made you decide, this is priceless, to have them do this on Halloween and play pranks on the agents, which I thought was hilarious?
Well, I had already had some of the pranks in there. And originally, I had written the book to happen in the spring, and because that's when the actual school experience was happening. It was, if you go back to Explorers Middle School, they had their actual classroom experience. It was in February and March. And so I had kind of based it in spring. And my agent came to me, she says, can we make this fall instead? Because we were looking at the October release, and she says, I really like it to be more around Halloween. I'm like, ooh. And as soon as, you know, she said that, and then my mind started going with some things that I could do to kind of season it up, shall we say. And then the next thing you know, I've got exploding pumpkins, you know, which I had a blast with, just coming up with some additional things that would be for the Halloween area. Plus, we already had the bats, which, you know, in the tunnels. So there were elements that were already there, and this just, it felt more natural, shall we say, to just kind of make it Halloween. And it was fun.
Halloween is scary, and because of that, it made it even better. Before I forget, the books that you need to read and buy for Hanukkah, Christmas, and Kwanzaa, you know, for kids, 7th Grade Revolution, I'm giving my copy to my niece. She's already got her hands out for it. A whole bunch of other kids in this building are going to want it also. I could tell you now, we've got a bunch of children in this building that read. I'm very proud to say that there is an anthology that deals with love, hope, and tolerance. It's called Limitless. I was allowed to write a synopsis. I couldn't write a review because I have a poem in it. And it's an anthology of a whole bunch of authors, and it's absolutely fantastic. Absolutely great, and I'm very proud that McGrath House included me in it. That's never happened before. Killing Season by Faye Kellerman was really good. Head Wounds, you can pre-order it, by Dennis Palumbo. And I just read Walt Freeland, his pop music albums, and it's got 57 discographies of different artists from the 20th century, like Louis Armstrong, Doris Day, Stephen Eady, Frank Sinatra, Sarah Vaughan, everything. It took me a while to read it because it's got about 500 pages. The print is small, but it's fantastic. So before we end, if Dennis and Rhonda could be on this interview, what would they say they learned about themselves and this whole experience?
Well, I think that Dennis would say that he learned that he does not have to be the lone wolf kind of character, that he can make friends and that there is value in having those friends and sticking around a place a little bit longer, and that friends make things worthwhile. And that's something that's kind of been missing from his life. And for Rhonda, I think that her biggest thing that she learned is that, well, kind of twofold. One is she realizes that what her father's been telling her entire life is that she's a leader and so forth, which she never believed, is actually true, that she can lead and that she does have value. And in addition to that, that she is able to face her fears and overcome them.
I think that was brought out very nicely. But what Maddie was trying to be the leader, and how would she view herself after this? How would she change the way she is? Or wouldn't she change the way she is?
I'm not sure that Maddie would change the way she is. Again, Maddie's somebody who likes the structure. And when you're in an unstructured environment, we even see that a little bit at the beginning when she's trying to take control and nobody's listening to her because the teachers are not providing the background structure for the room to be quiet. It's up to her. And all of a sudden, she doesn't really know what to do and how to bring everybody into compliance. So that was a little bit of a stretch for her, and she's realizing that maybe she's not quite the leader that she thought she was. Now, whether that would change her, I'm not really sure on that. I would have to actually spend more time with Maddie and see where her growth would be. She is a very kind and caring person, so that part wouldn't change. She likes people. She likes to be well thought of, and that's not going to change. So I think it's more along the leadership line that she would have maybe a want to change, but she really does like the structure. She had found that not having the structure was a little bit unsettling and unfamiliar. So that would be, for her, how to work in that environment a little bit more readily and easily for her.
I think the situation would have been different if there had been one teacher down there. And it might not have turned out as well, you don't know, because the teacher would have tried to take over. And even though Rhonda has the knowledge, you never know. Adults don't always listen. So before we close, I have a question about the FBI, because all I can tell you is I'm not going to tell anybody what the ending was. That was priceless. And Mrs. Rictanis comes back to the school, and they learn that you cannot trifle with these students, the FBI. So Agent Caldwell realizes that he's up against these seventh graders, and they weren't going to give in to him. So what did he learn about these seventh graders that he was surprised? Because you figure the FBI is coming in, I'm going to do what you say. Not them. They did not.
Right. And I think for Agent Caldwell, what he found is he does expect he's got something behind him called his organization and the FBI, and he's used to people listening to the FBI. Mm-hmm. And so he walks into the situation, like you said, and his expectation is he's going to run the show. He is going to tell them this is what's going to happen, this is how we're going to deal with it, and he figures he holds all the cards. Well, he finds out very quickly that he doesn't hold any of the cards because the kids have what he wants. And because they have what he wants, and they are not open to his threats basically threatening to lock them up. You know, well, we could just lock you up. And basically they know that they can get him to not do that because there's too many of them. There's too many people who have the knowledge that he wants, and it's not that they can take all of them. They could lock up a few of them. They could take Wanda and Dennis and say, you know, we're going to lock you up until you see things our way, but they were not going to listen. And he was thinking that these, again, he's coming from a perspective that a lot of adults come from and saying that kids, these are kids. They don't have anything that they can teach me. And that's so very untrue. Kids can teach us multitudes. And that's really what he learned from this.
I totally agree with you. I think parents don't always listen to their kids either when they're saying something. And they don't always hear what they're saying. They hear what they want to hear. And that's the problem with adults and children, that, you know, you have kids that hear what they want to hear. Even if you're telling them you're not in trouble, sometimes they look at you and go, well, I didn't do that. You know, I didn't do it. They automatically assume that they're in trouble. And there are some parents that actually, they have the answer in their head, but it's not always the answer that it should be. So before we close, can you tell everybody what is next for you and where we can find out more about your work?
You can always find more about my work on leannagardner.com, which is my website. There's also 7thGradeRevolution.com if you want to find anything out about the book and what's going on with that. What next is for me, I'm working on two different projects right now. One happens to be a children's chapter book series where the animals, the first one starts with the theme of bullying. The series is about different social issues and how to deal with them. It's called Timmy and the Golden Lion Tamarin. The first book in the series is about bullying, and Timmy gets a guardian angel animal who helps him deal with his bully. And the guardian angel animals are endangered species that come into the books to help out the kids with their issue. We have about 10 of the books already planned, and we're kind of working through those. They're not out yet. We're developing the package at this point. And then I'm also working on another middle grade series called the Homeless Myths series. And it is about myths that homeless children hold to help explain the world of chaos that they live in. And I take that concept and, of course, blow it completely out. But it'll be a five-book series, and the first book in the series, which I am currently drafting, is called The Star Warriors and the Secret of the Red Key.
That sounds interesting, and I do hope I get them before they come out, and I hope that you do another tour with Partners in the Crime, because they're the best. And for those of you that haven't read my new book, it's called The Daughter's Promise, and I'm doing a tour with Providence Books, and it's on there, it's on Amazon, and it's my promise never to put my mom in a nursing home, because she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2002, and it's my 10-year journey with taking care of her and keeping that promise, which is probably the hardest thing in the world for caregivers. And for those of you that have somebody in your family with that, it's a great resource to understand the disease and understand the person. So I want to thank you so very much for today. I want everybody to go out and buy a whole bunch of books for their teenagers and their kids, and buy Seventh Grade Revolution. And for those educators, buy The Mean by John Arthur Long. As a matter of fact, you should go on my review site and check out all the books and just buy them all. Seriously. I'm very lucky and fortunate that I get the best authors and the best people to interview. So, Leanna, I want to thank you so very much for today. I want everybody to have a great day. The sun is shining. Have a nice day, and bye.
Thank you very much.